about you.
Yeah, look, we've accepted a surveillance state, an Orwellian state in which we are the enemy. We being any whistleblower, any dissent, you know, Hillary Clinton can say that Edward Snowden's a traitor because he informed us what's going on. You have Microsoft now telling us the government won't even let us, Microsoft tell us they're snooping on our email. And so you have a surveillance society of vast proportions, technologically informed, great amount of data, and it can be used to intimidate the public. And what you saw attacking Democracy Now! Reporters is the pattern for the future.
I want to thank you, Robert Scheer, again, author of They Know Everything About You. That does it for our show. A very special thanks to the folks here at KCET Link in Los Angeles and to Kim Spencer. We're continuing our 100 City tour. Today we'll be at Skylight Books in Los Angeles and at Bookstar in Studio City tonight. I'll be on Bill Maher's show tonight on HBO. On Saturday we'll be in Santa Rosa, Willett and Redway, and on Sunday in Davis, Chico and Berkeley. Then we're on to Salt Lake City on Monday, Idaho Springs, Colorado, and Tuesday we'll be in Colorado. That does it for our broadcast. A special thanks to Chirina Nodura and Juan Carlos Davila, who are simply doing their jobs on the streets of New York last night. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Portland. The time is 5 p.m. And coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
David Barsamian will be speaking as a benefit for KBOO Community Radio Friday, May 13th at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. David is the host of Alternative Radio, now in its 30th year, and an award-winning investigative journalist. He will be speaking on one of the most critical issues we are faced with today, saving the planet that sustains us. Again, that's Friday, May 13th at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. All proceeds will benefit KBOO, your community radio station. Tickets and information for this event can be found at kboo.fm/Barsamian2016.
It's really nice to be here in Germany. We'll have to do something off our first album now. Take it, Diddy.
Hey. Join me, Marcel, April 15th from 10 to midnight as we celebrate Joey Ramone Day. 2 full hours of the Ramones. Today your love, tomorrow the world. That's Joey Ramone Day, April 15th from 10 to midnight. Right here on 90.7 FM, your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, presenting a City of Portland Council Candidate Forum and City of Portland Gas Tax Ballot Measure on Monday, April 25th at 6 p.m. at the Multnomah County Building Boardroom, 501 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. More information at lwvpdx.org. Coming up right now is your KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we hear from Portland Cop Watch and their efforts to track law enforcement uses of force across Oregon.
The Bureau of Land Management's proposed changes to forest lands in Oregon could affect a larger regional agreement.
And the Portland Rizwan Mosque invites the general public inside this weekend to talk about the myths of Islamic extremism and eat some great food.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 15th, 2016. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Jamie Haddad. The Oregonian reports today that an Ashland-based defense contracting company is accused of bribing the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and winning $171 million in military contracts. The company, called Sky Research, has been charged with criminal conspiracy. The owner, who goes by the one-word name Sky, allegedly gave kickbacks, including money, vacations, and meals, to obtain 9 Defense Department contracts to find and clean up old military debris. An Army Corps of Engineers manager, identified only as J.H., allegedly collected the kickbacks for 11 years. Sky's wife, Anne, told the Oregonian her husband has not been arrested.
The Ahmadiyya Muslim community in southwest Portland hosts a special event this weekend aimed at dispelling myths about Islam. KBOO News report, or rather KBOO News, spoke with Harris Safar about what's happening.
So this Saturday, so tomorrow, we are hosting an open event, a seminar here at the Portland Rizwan Mosque in southwest Portland. And it's entitled True Islam and the Extremists. And basically, what this is we've identified that there's this growing concern, not just here in Portland, but around the nation, about the role that Islam may play in this growth of extremism around the world. With what happened in Brussels and San Bernardino and Paris, there's a lot of concern around what's the role that Islam has to play in those actions. And we see a lot of people conflating Islam with the actions of extremists. So this event is to take a very bold look and have an open dialogue to talk about this alleged connection between the true teachings of Islam and the actions of the terrorists and the destruction that they create. We often like doing these outreach efforts, and so when somebody will come, this event will consist of a couple of presentations, one or two presentations, and an open Q&A session. So it's not just sitting and listening to lectures. It's also having your voice heard, and any questions or concerns that people have vis-a-vis Islam or anything else that they've heard. This is an opportunity to be in a safe place amongst Muslims and non-Muslims alike to have those questions answered. And then afterwards, we'll even, of course, like anytime we have anything in the mosque, we make sure everyone's well-fed, so we'll have refreshments and other things available so people can eat and have more kind of community conversations. So it begins at 12 p.m. tomorrow. I would say that the formal program should be done by 1. So it's a one-hour program, and we'll just let the questions go for as long as people would like and before breaking. And so if people have more, if they have any questions or if they're more interested, they can come to portlandmuslims.com. That's where they'll find more information about the event. They can register for the event as well. But ultimately, we're just looking for as many people to come to enrich the conversation.
The event is True Islam and the Extremists at the Portland Rizwan Mosque at 9925 Southwest 35th Drive. It starts at noon and refreshments are served. You can find out more at portlandmuslims.com.
Portland Cop Watch, The Scanner, and KBOO News have, for the past 2 years, collaborated on an effort to track law enforcement use of force across the state of Oregon. Oregon Senate Bill 111, passed into law in 2010, mandated that the Oregon Department of Justice collect statewide use of force reports and make them available to the public. But that has not happened until now. This week, the DOJ released to CopWatch its law enforcement fatality statistics for 2015. That came a month after CopWatch, The Scanner, and KBOO released our report showing 141 law enforcement use of force incidents, including 79 deaths between 2010 and 2015. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with Dan Handelman of CopWatch today, and this is what he had to say.
The Senate bill described the information that the state is supposed to collect and publish occasionally about people who are killed by law enforcement in the state of Oregon. It unfortunately doesn't require them to release the names of the officers, which became a big issue over this last session in the legislature. But it does say they should name the people who were killed, what their age and the race, gender were, and where it happened, and what the law enforcement agency was. And there's a preliminary list that's very similar to what's described that was provided to us by the Attorney General's office for the year 2015. The law does only cover people who died at the hands of police. So whereas we found, I think, 25 incidents in 2015, they only list 16 of them because only 16 of the people died. They have their age and race and gender, but they don't have the name. That's the thing that's bothersome. That these people lost their lives at the hand of the state, and they're not even being memorialized by their names. And moreover, there's also a column that says this is what happened, and it's very heavily weighted towards the law enforcement interpretation of what happened, where they're explaining, oh, the officers defended themselves, or just short language that makes it sound completely justified, and even if it was found justified by a grand jury or district attorney or any other kind of review, it comes off as a one-sided narrative.
For people that are unfamiliar with this issue, can you explain why does that matter?
Well, I think it matters a lot. Our group is part of a peace group, and we don't like to see the state take people's lives, whether it's in war, through the death penalty, or with police on the streets. And it's an incredible amount of power that we give to police officers when they shoot and kill somebody in the line of duty, and most of the time are found to be within policy, and there's no consequence for them, even though they took the life of a community member. Regardless of whether that community member is somebody that we agree with or not, whether that community member was acting in a violent manner or not, we're turning over the power to the state to take a person's life. And when we do that, the pendulum has definitely swung in the direction of there's a lot more taking of life than I think people thought was going to happen, and there's a lot less accountability for that taking of life than should be happening. And that's partly what sparked the Black Lives Matter movement. Certainly, a lot of the people who are being shot in around the country and have been shot in Portland over the course of history have been African Americans, and many of them have been unarmed. We're just looking at the whole situation of whose lives are being taken by law enforcement. And the point of Senate Bill 111 was to make it a public discussion so that there would be a feedback loop from the state to the community and back again. And it just feels like this is just the state telling us, oh, nothing to see here, move along. All these things were justified.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
The Oregon Food Bank's Fresh Alliance program inspects and sorts donated food from grocery stores that can no longer be sold so that it can be distributed to those with insecure food sources. National Volunteer Week is a celebration of programs like this one, which is volunteer-run. Emmy Kunze of KBOO News, in conjunction with the New Oregon News Service, has more.
It's National Volunteer Week, and some Oregonians are taking note by helping to feed those in need. Nearly 15% of Oregon families were food insecure or had trouble putting meals on the table at some point during 2014, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's last report on hunger. Oregon Food Bank's Fresh Alliance is looking where others aren't to reduce that number. Volunteer Jack Pendleton describes how the Alliance finds food for people facing hunger.
This is food that's donated by grocery stores, and when that comes in, we sort it out, make sure that we get all the fresh stuff, because some of it is a little out of date, and put it in containers for agencies to take.
Fresh Alliance is a statewide, volunteer-supported program that takes food from grocery stores, such as Safeway and Fred Meyer, that would otherwise be thrown away. Some of the food is heading out of the grocery store because it's blemished, or it's near its sellout or use-by date. However, the USDA says those dates are simply guidelines and food can still be safe near those dates. Pendleton and his volunteering peers at Fresh Alliance are like the middlemen between the grocery stores and agencies that distribute the food. They have the important duty of inspecting the meats, dairy products, and produce that come in, and then determining what is safe for consumption, all within 24 hours of receiving the food. For Pendleton, volunteering with Fresh Alliance gives him an opportunity to reflect on his own circumstances. The Fresh Alliance program is a big operation in Oregon. Since 2001, the program has redirected more than 80 million pounds of food from being wasted. It has also helped push the state toward higher waste recycling goals. Oregon hopes to recover 52% of waste by the year 2020. I'm Emmy Kunze with the KBOO Evening News.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. This will be followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Portland's weather tonight will be mostly cloudy with a low of 44. Tomorrow will begin with patchy fog and then will turn into a lovely sunny day with a high of 73. Then it's back to partly cloudy tomorrow night with a low of 50. Today in history, in 1947, Jackie Robinson became the first African-American player in Major League Baseball when he stepped into Ebbets Field in Brooklyn to compete for the Brooklyn Dodgers. The quote of the day is from Jackie Robinson, who said, "A life is not important except in the impact it has on other lives."
Companies that use social media accounts to mine for data are getting funding from the CIA. A new report from The Intercept names the 38 data mining companies that receive funds through the CIA's InQtel program. Dataminer, Geofedia, Zoom Data are just three of the many private companies with government contracts through the program. Using algorithms, social media analytics, and mapping technologies, data mining companies gain insight into upcoming protests and webs of radicalism. They even claim to predict levels of violence for police departments. To see the full list of named companies, visit TheIntercept.com.
Picket lines sprouted across the Northeast Wednesday as nearly 40,000 Verizon workers walked off the job. The strike in nine states and Washington, D.C. was called by two unions, Communication Workers of America and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and comes 8 months after their contracts expired. It's the second major strike against the telecom giant in the past decade and comes as Verizon pushes away from landline service and toward wireless. FSRN's Robert Packard talked to Chuck Simpson, the president of CWA Local 2204.
So first, bring us up to speed. Union contracts expired last August. What were the primary sticking points, and has there been any movement on them since?
Not really. Bargaining actually started June 22nd before contract expiration. And we are pretty much at the same point we were on the 22nd of June. The reason that we're on strike now is we think we have been at the table long enough and we have made offers to the company that we think are good enough that we should have been able to open up bargaining and settle and have contract and be ready to move forward. The issues for us are primarily protecting our retirees' benefits. Those folks that have come before us and retired have been able to retire with health care, and the company is willing to keep health care for the individuals at this time, but they're looking to cost shift a lot of the expenses in the retiree's health care back to the actual retiree, which we don't think that's fair because retirees are living on a fixed pension and Social Security. They don't have any means to be working for the company anymore, making any overtime or having any cost of living raises, so we want to protect them and the benefits that they've earned. The other two pieces really are job security and growing jobs. And also the other issue, of course, is with the lack of workforce and the dwindling down of people who've left payroll, the company haven't backfilled. So, for an example, the technicians who work outside in my area in Southwest Virginia, Central Virginia, Shenandoah Valley, and Southside, A lot of our techs are trained in Fios service, but the fiber optic service that makes up Fios is not here in our area. It's in Eastern Virginia or Northern Virginia or Richmond. So our techs have to travel to those areas to work. So they send our guys out of town 10 days at a time to go there and work, and they're usually going at least one trip a month. Of course, if Verizon chose to hire back to its capacity the number of employees it needed, then there wouldn't be this continuous fluid movement of workers across the footprint.
CWA Local 2204 President Chuck Simpson, your union said in a statement about the strike that, quote, Verizon's corporate greed isn't just harming workers' families, it's hurting customers as well, unquote. What sort of effects are customers experiencing? And as some critics have said, could the strike be exacerbating those effects?
Well, the problems that the consumer is facing with the greed situation of Verizon, it appears that when Verizon wants to cut operating costs, the first place they look at is the front line of workers. So as I said, as people have left payroll, whether they've left on their own, they've been terminated or what, Verizon doesn't backfill those jobs. So there is an issue there where customers are calling in to talk about getting their service repaired. They're calling in about wanting to talk to somebody about moving their service or changing their bill. They're having trouble getting through, even when we're not on strike. They're having a hard time trying to reach anyone. So in cutting operating costs and not having enough call center jobs open for people to talk to individuals and get their problems solved, they're frustrated because they're spending a lot of time on the phone. Same thing with the technicians. When you cut down on the people that are in the field and you try to get more work done with less personnel, it's extremely hard for that to come about. And so there are a lot of missed appointments during the day. That all comes from the fact that shaving operations off at the bottom and limiting personnel increases the profit for the company and yet causes a hindrance to the customer.
What kind of agreement does Verizon need to reach with union leaders in order to resolve the strike? And is there any sort of expected time frame for a potential resolution at this point?
Well, what they need to do in order to resolve this situation, which would be the contract from here all the way to Massachusetts, they would need to be able to guarantee CWA that we would continue to have job security for our people on the payroll, and there wouldn't be threats of laying them off and replacing them with other types of workers. They need to add jobs and grow jobs because there's a need out there for it now. We are the trained personnel. We continuously train. We're the ones that have the capability to do the job, and don't try to shrink us out of existence mainly because of the fact that you want to have a cheaper workforce and a more fluid workforce and a less cost of operations to drive up profit. They want to shrink our workforce. They want to eventually try to do away with having union workers, which would mean more cost and more profit for them because they feel it's an obligation to them that, as far as what they're paying, that they want to diminish and do away with that. And also the fact that they want to be able to operate with whatever type of workforce they can utilize, because we don't see a phone company anymore. We don't see a communications company anymore, an entertainment company anymore. It's more like they're a financial instrument. The more money they save, the better the stock value is, the more people are willing to invest, and then, of course, they can pay dividends back to the stock investors. That makes people want to invest even more. And naturally, the stock value is where this needs to go for them, because the CEO, the board of directors, all those people in upper management, that's where their compensation is, in stock shares. And bottom line is, if they're making $1.5 billion of profit every month, they're not strapped or not hurting like they were back in 2011 when we gave them some leeway when the market was down and they were impacted. You know, now they're making the profit and we're helping them make the profit, and we want to be part of the company and we want to continue to grow. A lot of us have careers here and we want to be able to retire and have our pensions. So that's what we're fighting for, and we will continue to fight because we think the middle class deserves it.
Chuck Simpson is the president of CWA Local 2204 and joined us by phone from Salem, Virginia. For FSRN, I'm Robert Packard.
Climate news can often be depressing. One study after another confirms grim, worse-than-we-thought predictions while policymakers take little or no action. But occasionally there are small victories to report, and recent days have brought a couple of long-sought-after wins for the little guys. Melinda Tuhus has more from New Haven.
An hour before UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon delivered a speech at Yale this week, the university announced that it divested $10 million in coal and tar sands investments out of its $25.6 billion endowment. Its rationale is that such investments are unlikely to be profitable if carbon pricing is ever put in place that would reflect the true cost to the climate of burning fossil fuels. While Ban lavished praise on Yale President Peter Salovey for the move, the students from the group Fossil Free Yale claimed credit for this first step toward divestment after 5 years of campaigning. Freshman Arabelle Schoenberg spoke at a rally the day of the divestment announcement.
And this partial victory is an important first step, although it does not reflect an ethics-based, university-wide commitment to divestment. Hopefully it represents a change in the consciousness of these universities and really a step towards what we've been fighting for all along. So thank you guys all for coming. It's really awesome to have you.
Yale's chief investment officer, David Swenson, said the endowment now includes only minor investments in coal and oil. Fossil Free Yale intends to keep pushing the university to divest completely from all fossil energy, including natural gas. Also at Yale last week, former NASA climate scientist James Hansen spoke on campus. He was the first to testify before Congress back in 1988 that global warming from burning fossil fuels was already occurring. He is now a professor at Columbia University and spoke about his controversial new paper, which posits that sea level rise will likely happen much faster and higher than more conservative estimates, like that from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, have predicted. Hansen said the planet is absorbing more energy than it's releasing, and to restore the energy balance requires steep reductions in CO2 emissions. He spoke just the day before a federal judge in Oregon handed down a favorable ruling in a lawsuit he and our children's trust had brought against the federal government over what legal rights future generations have to a stable climate.
We're asking the government to give a plan for how they're going to reduce emissions at a rate that would be consistent with restoring the planet's energy balance in a century. And if we did that, I think we probably could minimize sea level rise.
The April 8th ruling determined that the federal government must protect public resources like air, water, and land held in common under the public trust doctrine. The judge rejected the Obama administration's claims that it is addressing the climate crisis through the actions of its Environmental Protection Agency. The fossil fuel industry also weighed in against the lawsuit. Kelsey Juliana is a 20-year-old college student and a plaintiff in the case, which was filed last summer. She had filed a similar case against the state of Oregon when she was 15, and that case is still winding its way through the courts. She said what's unique about these cases is that they extend the traditional definition of public resources.
The atmosphere is this all-encompassing resource that all life depends on to survive, and damage to the atmosphere results in damage to our water, to our climate, to our land. So by, you know, any negligence on protecting this all-encompassing resource, we're actually falling short on protecting those natural systems already recognized and, you know, held under this protection by the public trust.
Asked about the Our Children's Trust lawsuit, Fossil Free Yale member Emma Phelps agreed that it's a very important development.
It's showing that the people who are causing climate change, the corporations, the fossil fuel industry, and the government are actually being held to account in a court of law, and especially recognizing the concrete harms that climate change is causing right now and will cause in the future in a way that is basically saying that the government is being negligent for not acting. And I think that that's very relevant as far as our campaign is another way of young people also fighting for the climate.
While not directly a defendant, the fossil fuel industry petitioned to be an intervener defendant in the case on the side of the Obama administration, claiming that if the lawsuit moves forward, it would be a direct threat to its interests. Juliana explains what a victory might look like.
That would mean that the fossil fuel industry would get no more rubber stamping from federal agencies to continue to create and expand export and mining and extraction and fracking projects. And there would be instead investments in renewable energy.
The judge's decision is pending review by another judge in the same court before the lawsuit can move forward. Leading climate activists Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein have called it the most important case on the planet right now. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Haven.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Emmy Kunze, Jamie Haddad, Tony Longshanks, Jeff Henderson, and Lisa Loving. The producer is David Kesters. Engineering tonight is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Jamie Haddad.
And I'm Liam Delta. Stay tuned now for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6, and have a great weekend. Good night, Jamie.
Good night, Liam.